From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. She's got 3 Grammy Awards and 15 nominations.
Told me, baby, one more time. Don't make me sit all alone and cry while it's over. I know it, but I can't let go. I'm like a fish out of water, a cat in a tree. You don't even want to talk to me while it's over.
That's songwriter Lucinda Williams performing Can't Let Go. She's in Atlanta tonight, and we'll talk with her this hour. Georgia attracts a lot of country artists. So, who are your favorites and why? Tell us. Give us your pitch for listening to your favorite country music singer or songwriter. Call us at 404-500-9457 and leave a message. Maybe sing a little. We're also on Twitter or on Facebook. Remember, we might feature your comments on the show. You know, it seems like a ridiculous premise for a TV show. Mad scientists want to take over the world, so they force a janitor and 2 robots to watch awful, really awful movies to see which film will drive humanity mad. That's a clip from the TV series Mystery Science Theater 3000. It was a big cult hit until it just vanished about 15 years ago. Now, thanks to Netflix and a big crowdfunding campaign, it's back. For the first time, MST3K hits the road with a live show that comes to Atlanta Saturday. This week, my colleague Adam Ragusea spoke to the show's creator, Joel Hodgson.
For anyone listening who has never seen Mystery Science Theater 3000, could you briefly summarize the completely bonkers premise of your program?
Well, normally, if I'm sitting next to somebody on a plane and the conversation goes to what I do, I tend to bring out my sketchbook and I'll draw a picture of a movie screen and little theater seats with 3 characters, a man and 2 robots, that talk during the movie. And most people, when they see that, they'll go, oh, right, that. And they get to it. And so that's usually how I explain it. Because sometimes, you know, the way people, it's really hard to explain, I think. That's why I made it into a TV show, so I wouldn't have to explain it.
But there is a premise behind it. It's not just a couple of silhouetted figures watching old movies in the public domain so that you don't have to pay for them and making fun of them.
Yeah, there's a narrative there where it's very loose, but the mad scientists are trying to find the worst movie ever made, and they keep screening them, hoping to kind of break our hero, which is Jonah Heston. And he's got a couple of robot companions that hang out with him and watch the movies with him and talk.
Let's listen to a little clip from the debut episode.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Satellite of Love. I'm Joel Robinson, and these
are... Oh, you see? He introduced himself. What a perfectly thoughtful thing to do.
Yes, these are my robots, Tom Servo and Crow, and I've installed in them a protocol module that makes them believe everything I think, say, or do is utterly brilliant.
Oh, and it is, Joel. God, yes. Oh,
Roger
Joel.
Penrose on his best day isn't half as brilliant or as charming as you, I might add.
Okay. So to recap, Joel, Mystery Science Theater 3000 is a show in which... the hero of the program has been imprisoned by mad scientists on a spaceship called the Satellite of Love. These mad scientists are trying to find the worst movie ever so that they can drive humanity mad with it, I guess, and conquer the world. They are forcing our hero in the early iterations of the program, it's you, Joel, forcing our hero to watch a succession of terrible films. Our hero has built 2 robots to keep him company and help him snark and make fun of the movies, thus immunizing him from the maddening effects of said films. This debuted on a local station in Minneapolis-St. Paul in the late 80s. How did you ever convince a succession of television executives that this was a marketable idea?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I think originally when I got to the idea, I thought it would be really hard to do because this is 1988, and almost 30 years ago, and there was no such thing as creating a TV show where the performers and the audience share the same screen. And I didn't think anyone would let me do it. My first position was, I know about these public domain movies that are like adorable and like Robot Monster and Plan 9 from Outer Space, But I quickly found out you can't really just use public domain movies. They have to be licensed because, you know, someone has to maintain the print. And so we pretty much have to license everything. And my first position was what was the cheapest show I could make, because I didn't trust my ability to talk executives into anything. And I felt that I could talk an audience into something. So I started out by making Mystery Science Theater, which was the cheapest show I could think of, because I thought it would be fueled with public domain movies. And all we would need is a green screen and a little set, and we'd be able to make it. So that was my first position. And that's how we did it. We got it on a local UHF channel. We started a fan club. We started to get press. And so we had this really nice package of about 8 minutes of our funniest riffs. And I went to Comedy Channel, which became Comedy Central, and I pitched it to a guy I knew there named Stu Smiley, who was the head of Comedy Channel. And so we had a pretty compelling package with good press, local press from Minneapolis, and 8 minutes of our funniest stuff. So that's kind of how I did it. And then it just kind of went from there. Once they put it on Comedy Channel, I didn't have to do anything. It kind of took care of itself.
The bulk of the program is our hero and his two robot pals just looking up at that screen along with the audience, watching this some silly old film and snarking on it. There are interstitial sketches in between, but the bulk of the programming is just the fellow and the robots snarking at an old movie. So let's listen to a couple of clips from a 1997 episode of Mystery Science Theater 3000. This is in which the MST gang is watching and commenting on a 1975 low-budget sci-fi film called The Giant Spider Invasion.
Does it matter that the spider ate him with his butt?
Well, I think it seems suitable for this guy.
Can you imagine how many interns it took to pull that guy up into the spider?
Just when things were really looking up for her.
Any of you ladybugs have any comments about the spider?
No, it's spider season and we didn't wear orange.
That's a clip from Mystery Science Theater 3000. We are speaking to its creator, Joel Hodgson. Mystery Science Theater 3000 is back on Netflix, and it also has a live show, a touring live show that is coming to Atlanta on Saturday. Joel, it strikes me when I watch Mystery Science Theater 3000 now, I mean, I watched it a lot in high school in the 90s when I was a kid, but when I was sort of rewatching it again to get ready to talk to you, it was just amazing to me how much this program that you made prior to the explosion of the internet really anticipated much of internet culture, the recapping of other culture, running commentary. There's YouTubers who basically do what you did 20 years ago, where they just watch something along with the audience and comment on it. What do you make of that parallelism?
Well, I appreciate you noticing that. I think in a weird way we did anticipate some of it, and I think that comes from the theory of a shared screen. And it was very hard to do when we started. It was unheard of, and that's why I had to start at the bottom pretty much and start with at a UHF channel. I really didn't think I could go to a network and get anyone to, you know, buy into it. But I think it really comes from sharing a screen, and now we all share screens, and so that's just a natural kind of position for us to be in. I think Mystery Science Theater is the first show that may have done that. I can't think of other ones where the audience and the comics are like looking at the same thing and participating because they're sharing that. Other than that, it was just a happy accident. And the other thing about movie riffing is the other important thing is that it happened right at the beginning of cable. And cable had an immense amount, a big hunger to fill with content. And our show was 90 minutes long and very refillable. We did almost 200 episodes on cable. And because it was kind of unheard of, we weren't really like trying to emulate any shows. So we just filled it with whatever we felt like it and kind of pleased ourselves. And that was the other piece of it, is we never thought, who's going to get this? We just always said the right people will get it. And I think that really fits in with, social media culture now.
You have brought the show back to Netflix thanks to upwards, well, more than $5 million in crowdfunding that you raised. And it's back, and it's better than ever. You've got a lot of cool people involved in it. Let's listen to a clip of the new Netflix version of Mystery Science Theater 3000, featuring big-name comics Felicia Day and Patton Oswalt playing the new Mads, that is the mad scientists who are conducting this experiment to see which movie will most effectively drive humanity insane. Here they are introducing another B-rated film to which they're going to subject our hero.
The new MST3K isn't about ideas or making things. It's about sheer star power, starting with your experiment today, Reptilicus. Somehow Denmark thought they could make a giant monster movie. Max, tell them a few of the big celebrity names in the film.
Only a legendary Danish comic actor Dirk Passer.
Wow. And?
He's the only one.
We've got to talk about the way we choose these movies.
Felicia Day and Patton Oswalt in the newest, latest version of Mystery Science Theater 3000 on Netflix these days. We're talking to Mystery Science Theater 3000 creator Joel Hodgson. Joel, you are bringing a stage version of the show to Atlanta on Saturday. What does the stage version of Mystery Science Theater 3000 consist of?
Well, we tried to realize, the actual show on stage. So it's a real production, and prior, iterations of MST3K on the stage were really like table reads of Mystery Science Theater. You know, it's just usually us standing at microphones talking. And so the whole idea was to bring the characters to life, have meet all the robots, Tom Servo, Crow, and Gypsy, and see, King and Max do video visits from Moon 13, as well as creating the Satellite of Love on stage and the doorway sequence, and finally going into the Mystery Science Theater. So we tried our best to realize all that stuff, and it's gone really beautifully. We were thrilled. I mean, this is our last week of a 6-week tour. We've done played in 26 cities and about 40 shows, and I've had just a wonderful time introducing this new cast. Jonah Ray and Hampton Yunt and Tim Ryder's Tom Servo this summer for us, and Rebecca Hansen, Grant Pachoco. And so it's been really cool getting to go out. I think I've had the best summer of my life, actually.
That's Joel Hodgson, the creator of Mystery Science Theater 3000. He spoke with my colleague Adam Ragusea earlier this week. A live version of that show comes to Atlanta Symphony Hall with performances Saturday night at 7 and 10 o'clock. Just ahead, Lucinda Williams is back on the road, and she's got a tour stop in Atlanta. First, though, making sense of police shootings of unarmed black men. This is On Second Thought. It's been 3 years since 18-year-old Michael Brown was shot dead by a Ferguson, Missouri police officer. The officer was white, Brown was black.
Ferguson confirms they shot and killed a suspect. According to Mike Brown's mother, that suspect is her 18-year-old son.
After their exhaustive review of the evidence, the grand jury deliberated over 2 days, making their final decision. They determined that no probable cause exists to file any charge against Officer Wilson.
This tear gas just dropped right near us. It's going to get very bad here if we don't have masks.
The chaos in Ferguson brought to light deeper and disturbing issues involved in policing African Americans. American University Law Professor Angela Davis has edited an anthology of essays about black men and boys who've died at the hands of police. It's called Policing the Black Man. Angela speaks tonight at the Atlanta History Center and joins us now. It's such a pleasure to welcome you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, this anthology focuses specifically on men and boys instead of girls. Why is that?
Well, it specifically focuses on black men, actually, black men and boys. And it's because their experience in the criminal justice system is in many ways unique, primarily because they are treated worse than any of these other groups. For example, black boys are more likely to be referred to the juvenile justice system than any other children. Black men are disproportionately arrested. African Americans are, in fact, 2.5 times more likely to be arrested than whites. And 49%, almost half of black men, can expect to be arrested at least once by age 23. Black men are more likely to be killed or injured during a police encounter, 21 times more likely, as a matter of fact, than white men. And the number of black men in prison or jail or on probation or on parole by the end of 2009 roughly equaled the number that were enslaved in 1850. So all of the statistics show that black men and boys are treated worse in the system than their similarly situated white counterparts. And by that I mean whites who have alleged to have committed the same or engaged in the same behavior are treated better than black men and boys.
That point you make is quite important, and it's one that's laid out pretty carefully in different essays in the book, is the comparison of apples to apples. In other words, there's mm-hmm. been a creation of this stereotype in the United States that African Americans, especially men and boys, are more likely to commit criminal acts, whereas, as you mentioned, the statistics show that basically the punishment for the exact same offense committed by a white person is all out of proportion. Do we have any idea why?
Well, it's complex. I think it's a confluence of different factors. And this has been studied by so many people. I think there is bias in the system. I don't think it's as simple as saying that criminal justice officials are racist. I think that's too simplistic. I think that there's this thing called implicit bias that is talked about in a number of the essays, especially in Catherine Russell Brown's essay where she explains it. Implicit bias is something that all human beings experience, you know, the unconscious views that we all have in society based on stereotypes in the media and elsewhere around us that cause us to have these unconscious views about other people based on race, gender, ethnicity, skin color, all kinds of things. But when people in the criminal justice system who have power, like police officers and prosecutors and judges, when their implicit bias influences the decisions that they make in the system, then it is a problem. And there's so much discretion that so many of these actors in the system have, especially police and prosecutors, that the implicit bias becomes a factor, and a lot of discretionary decisions cause them to, you know, sometimes unconsciously treat African Americans worse than others in the system.
And
there are other reasons as well.
Yeah, this is something that you go into in detail in your essay on prosecutors. I want to play this comment from John Gleason, who's a federal judge in New York. He is very critical of mandatory minimum sentences for drug crimes, especially. Here he is speaking with NPR.
Plea bargains are struck in the United States Attorney's Office. Nobody sees them happen. There's no transparency. Transparency in and of itself is a very important value in our system. And we don't have enough of it. The trials are disappearing.
Why do you say that prosecutors are such a crucial component of changing what happens with the policing of black men?
Judge Gleason has it just right. Prosecutors are the most powerful officials in our criminal justice system, bar none, because they have the charging and plea bargaining powers that Judge Gleason talked about. And they get to decide whether a person is in the system or not. I think people focus on police officers, and rightly so, because they have a lot of discretion on the street to stop a person, search a person, and so on. But they can only bring a person to the courthouse door. It is the prosecutor who decides whether that person is charged, whether they remain in the system and become entrenched in the system. So prosecutors, for example, are not required to charge an individual, even if there's probable cause, which is the standard they have to meet, to charge them. So that's where the discretion comes in and where the disparities come in. If you charge one person and not another who is similarly situated, you're creating an unwarranted disparity. And prosecutors alone have that power as the plea bargaining power. They decide whether to offer a plea to a person. They could, for example, charge a person with three or four counts of, let's say, distribution of cocaine. And again, to charge, they only have to meet that very low standard of probable cause, more likely than not, which is far lower than the more difficult standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt that they have to meet at trial. So a person who's faced with four or five charges that have been piled on, and again, prosecutors sometimes bring these charges even when they know they can't ultimately prove them because it gives them an advantage at this stage of the process. And even an innocent person, when faced with four or five mandatory minimum sentences, charges that carry mandatory minimum sentences of 5 or 10 years in prison on the bottom, even an innocent person, when faced with those odds, might plead guilty to one of those charges to avoid being convicted on all of them if the case goes to trial.
Yeah. I'm speaking with American University Law Professor Angela Davis. She edited the book Policing the Black Man. Angela speaks tonight at the Atlanta History Center. Well, the book starts after your introduction. The first essay is by criminal defense lawyer Brian Stevenson, and he writes about something that happened to him in Atlanta, a case in which a white police officer pulled a gun on him and threatened to kill him. Here he is speaking to NPR about that.
And he was just so menacing and threatening, and he kept saying, "Move and I'll blow your head off." And a second officer got out of the car, came behind my car, came up behind me, threw me on the back of the vehicle, and wouldn't let me reach in my wallet to get my driver's license to show that this is where I lived. Neighbors were coming out. People were complaining about other burglaries in the neighborhood. They were asking the police to interrogate me.
Okay, so here is the rest of that story told by lawyer Brian Stevenson.
I was terrified. A kid growing up in the country, that was my first instinct. And I was, at that point, a lawyer who had done police misconduct and civil rights cases for several years. And so I knew to say, it's all right, it's okay. But I had to take control of that situation and calm everybody down. And that's terrifying.
And this is an underlying theme throughout many of the essays, is this fear that African-American men especially have to face, that no matter what their attainments are, it's kind of the Skip Gates, the Henry Louis Gates Jr. syndrome. No matter who you are, no matter what you've attained, you're at the mercy of America's law enforcement policy. How do you think that affects African-American, not just youth, but especially adults?
Oh, it affects them tremendously. I was so happy that Brian Stevenson accepted my invitation to join the project, and he describes what happened to him in even more detail in his essay. But it's also talked about in a chapter on racial profiling by Professor Renee Hutchins of the University of Maryland. It is this notion, and I should also say by Kristen Henning, who writes a chapter about black boys and how they are treated, even worse than black men, by the way. It's horrifying. I mean, the mere existence of a black boy's, black man's mere existence causes him to be seen as criminal. Police officers, and not just police officers, but certainly it becomes when police officers who have power, they can inflict violence and do inflict violence on men and boys. But most people, again, getting back to implicit bias, when they see a black man or boy, they automatically think criminal. They're automatically suspicious. And several of the essays describe a number of studies that have been done that demonstrate how police officers in particular, when they see black men and boys, they tend to see a harm or suspicion when it's not there. Studies done about police officers and how they react to black boys described in Chris Henning's chapter, for example, talk about how police officers tend to overestimate the age and size of black boys and underestimate the age of white boys because they just see, again, because of implicit bias, danger when it does not exist. They will see some of the testing done show that they will see a weapon in the hand of a black man or boy when it's not there, and not see it in the hand of in the hands of white men and boys when it's there. So that's rather frightening when you think about the day-to-day life of a black man or boy, or mother who has to send her son out and give them the talk about how they have to behave all the time just to make themselves appear less suspicious. That's a tremendous burden that no child, no black boy or man should have to face. But it's the reality in this country today.
In fact, here is actor LeVar Burton speaking to CNN's Don Lemon about that very thing, not only what he does when he's pulled over by the police, but what he's taught his children to do.
When I get stopped by the police, I take my hat off and my sunglasses off. I put them on the passenger side. I roll down my window. I take my hands. I stick them outside the window and on the door of the driver's side because I want that officer to be as relaxed as he can be when he approaches my vehicle. And I do that because I live in America.
So this is sort of where the book is tending in all of the essays, is what do we do about it, right? If so many of these biases are implicit, and often people, I mean, that's what implicit means. They're not even aware of them. And because when a police officer is charged with either manslaughter or murder, they can make the argument, I was afraid for my life. And they could be telling the truth because it's based on implicit bias, right? So how do you fix that?
Right. Well, several of the essays talk about that. And what the studies show is that when implicit bias is made explicit, and that's part of Catherine Russell Brown's title to her chapter, when it's made explicit, when people are made aware of their biases, they can be trained not to act on them. And so there is a lot of implicit bias training out there today that works. And there are a number of jurisdictions across the country that are engaged in implicit bias training for all of the actors or officials in the criminal justice system, from police to prosecutors to judges, to make them aware of this bias. There's some judges, there's one judge in particular, Judge Fred Bennett, who is a federal judge, who has a jury instruction that he reads to jurors so that the jurors are not acting on their implicit bias when they are making decisions. So it can be weeded out with training, but there has to be the will on the part of officials in our criminal justice system to engage in that training.
So let's hear one more voice on this. This is Michelle Alexander, author of the book The New Jim Crow. She argues that Jim Crow, of course, and racial segregation were just replaced by mass incarceration. So here she is speaking with journalist Bill Moyers about discriminatory hiring practices and how that arrest record can follow you around.
You know, box unemployment applications that ask that dreaded question, have you ever been convicted of a felony? And, of course, it doesn't matter whether you've been convicted of a felony a few weeks ago or 40 years ago. For the rest of your life, you're labeled a felon and then subject to legal discrimination.
So how do you respond, Angela, to those who say, look, just keep your nose clean and you won't have an encounter with a police officer? Behave the right way when a police officer pulls you over and it's not going to go the wrong way. How do you respond to that?
Because I respond by saying case after case after case shows us that behaving properly, doing what you're told, doesn't help. We've seen it, you know, on videotape. Unfortunately, we witnessed the murders of so many of these men who were not doing anything. Terrence Crutcher had his hands up in the air when Officer Betty Shelby shot him. Two cameras showed that, and she was found not guilty. There's Kate Philando Castile. I can go on and on. We have videotapes black men who are saying, "Officer, my hand is here. I'm not doing anything," and yet they were killed anyway. And so the notion that by just doing the right thing, you can avoid this is just belied by the facts. It just doesn't happen. And I so appreciate what Michelle Alexander said because, you know, being arrested can lead to all kinds of collateral consequences, and she mentioned just one. And that's why the book, the subtitle of the book is Arrest, Prosecution, and Imprisonment. We try in these essays to talk not just about how police officers treat Black men, but about how the entire system polices Black men or controls them at every step of the process from arrest through sentencing. And most of the authors try to come up with ideas for reform that we hope the public will read and consider and hopefully implement, because there's no problem out here today, in my opinion, that's more difficult, more unjust, more unfair than how people of color, and particularly Black men and boys, are treated in our criminal justice system.
That's American University Law Professor Angela Davis. She has edited an anthology titled Policing the Black Man. It's about police killings and incarceration of Black men and boys. She speaks tonight at 8 o'clock at the Atlanta History Center. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Just ahead, Grammy Award-winning musician Lucinda Williams. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Next week, we talk about football injuries and the brain. A recent study of the brains of more than 100 former professional football players found all but one had degenerative brain disease. So does this change the way you feel about youth football? Does your kid play? Call and leave us a message at 404-500-9457, and then be sure to join us next Tuesday for more. There are a lot of songwriters out there, but very few whose work stands the test of time.
Are you all right? All of a sudden you went away. Are you all right? I hope you come back around someday. Are you all right?
An absolutely distinctive voice. That is Lucinda Williams performing Are You All Right? This year, Rolling Stone magazine named her one of the 100 greatest country artists of all time. She has won 3 Grammy Awards, including one for Best Country Song in 1994. And in her 4 decades of recording on a dozen studio recordings, Williams has played everything from blues to folk to straight-ahead rock. She's now on tour promoting her 14-song album, The Ghosts of Highway 20, and Lucinda Williams joins me now. Such an honor. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So, The Ghosts of Highway 20, you're talking about a real highway, the one that goes straight through Atlanta, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it runs through some of the towns I grew up in, like Vicksburg, Mississippi, where my brother was born, and Jackson, where my sister was born, and Macon, Georgia, where I started school. And what gave me the idea for the song really was having gone back to perform in Macon, Georgia, at the original Cox Theater in downtown Macon that had just been renovated. And that's where the Allman Brothers used to play back in the day and everything. And I was really just being in downtown Macon again, you know, and seeing how little had changed. And, you know, it just brought back a flood of memories. And then as we were leaving after the show, I was looking out the window from the bus and I noticed, you know, I was looking at the exit signs off the highway and I realized, wow, I kept seeing exit signs for Vicksburg and Jackson and, you know, and then, so I just realized that it was kind of a thread running through, you know, these significant places. And I kind of look at that, the song itself is sort of like Car Wheels in a Gravel Road Part 2 in a way, because at Car Wheels, I was the child in the back seat, little bit of dirt mixed with tears, looking out the window. And in Ghost of Highway 20, I'm driving the car, and looking out the window and looking back. So it just kind of ties all that together.
Well, let's actually hear the title track from that album, The Ghosts of Highway 20.
Rooting and restless, neath the cracked concrete. If you were from here, you would tell me.
So the place is something that you write about a lot in your songs, and I'm wondering what you think about the power of place. In other words, especially let's look at Macon. It's a place where Little Richard came from, and Otis Redding and James Brown played there, and the Allman Brothers. What is it about certain places that inspire that kind of creativity?
That's a good question. You know, I've heard people say that about towns like Lubbock, Texas, for instance, you know. And I remember, I think it was Butch Hancock or Joe Ely said something like, well, there's just not much going on there, you know. And it kind of created, you know, I guess a need for creativity, or I don't know. Well, I do know that, I mean, the South, I grew up all over the South, and, you know, it's always been a very rich, culturally rich area. That's another thing the song is about, is it's not just, you know, it's looking back on where I was from and all, but it's also, you know, like you were saying, that the artists, you know, the Delta blues artists who are off from all over around there, and, you know, who are buried around there, and just, you know, it's a combination of things. I guess the ghosts are kind of the spirits of the memories.
So one of my favorite songs on the new album is Dust. Let's take a listen to it. But it starts with just, there's a sadness so deep the sun seems black. It's just an incredible song. Let's take a listen.
You couldn't cry if you wanted to. Couldn't cry if you wanted to. You couldn't cry if you wanted to. Even your thoughts are dust. Even your thoughts are dust. Even your thoughts are dust.
You know, you're pretty well known for taking your time in putting out albums and in writing songs. How do you know when a song's done?
That's a good question, too. Well, personally, for me, what happens a lot of times is I become so moved, just kind of overwhelmed with the emotion of it all, that it makes me cry. And, you know, I'll stop and just kind of have to have that moment, because it's so cathartic, it's therapeutic. So I know that if I'm being affected in that way, that, you know, I've gotten inside the pulse, you know, the heartbeat of the song, and, you know, the main thing of it is there. And then it's just a matter of editing and kind of fixing it up.
So then how do you, you know, there's only one track on this album that you didn't write the music for, and that's Factory, which is a Springsteen song, although the lyrics of two of the other songs were written by other people, one of them by your dad.
That one, yeah, Dust.
Yeah.
That one, yeah.
So when you choose, I mean, when you're choosing a song by someone else to do, what goes into that choice? I mean, for example, why Factory? How did that one fit in?
Yeah, it's really important, too, because, you know, it's a big deal for me to do a song by somebody else.
Yeah.
You know, and I really have to, you know, be able to get into the lyrics and relate to it and all of that, and, of course, like the melody and feel good when I'm singing it. And so Tom, who's also my manager, my husband and manager, he suggested that song, Factory, by Bruce Springsteen, and we worked it up and performed it, and I just fell in love with it. And, you know, the other thing is Tom grew up in a factory town. His dad worked at the Hormel meatpacking plant in Austin, Minnesota for 30-plus years. So, you know, he grew up in that environment, and that line about men walk through these gates with death in their eyes, Tom said to me, he said, I've seen those men. You know, And it's just a great song, and it's, I think it's really relevant for right now, too.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with country musician legend Lucinda Williams. Her latest album is The Ghosts of Highway 20. You know, I read a comment you made about your dad, and you said, I remember him not really being accepted by the New York poetry world. It wasn't cool to be from the South back then like it is now.
Mm-hmm.
So when do you think that changed?
That's hard to say exactly, but I just remember, you know, in the early 60s, I just remember hearing my dad, you know, talk about he was supposed to get a job in publishing or something in New York City, and, you know, we all packed everything and piled into the station wagon and drove up there, and then the job fell through because the owner gave it to his son or something like that. Mm. I could just remember stories like that. And also, just from my own perspective growing up, I mean, you know, there just always have been these stereotypes about the South and Southerners, and I saw a lot of that myself.
But I wanted to talk to you about the song My Love Could Kill,
mm-hmm.
Which is about Alzheimer's, and that's the disease that claimed your father's life.
Yes.
If my love could kill, if my love could kill, I would kill this. I would kill this.
And I've always wondered what that must be. That song is so raw to me.
Yeah.
And I wonder what that's like to sing it over and over.
Well, I know, yeah. I mean, you know, we don't perform it as much as other songs because it is really, you know, it's so intense. And it depends on the venue. It depends on the, you know, where we are and everything. And, you know, if it's kind of a stand-up rock venue or a sit-down venue, you know. I mean, I like performing it, though, because I like the feeling of, you know, what it says, which is basically, you know, there's an anger. I mean, I wrote it because I was destroyed and sad, but also angry at this monster, you know, the disease. There are a lot of songs like that, you know, I relive the feeling every time I sing it, but that's a good thing, though.
Well, let me play another one that, to me, just sounds so personal. It's like you're opening up a chest and bleeding out, and that's Doors of Heaven.
Mm.
Open up the doors of heaven and let me. I think I'm finally tired of living. Let me in. I'm gonna walk in the glory, tell everyone my soul. Open up the doors of heaven and let me. I try to live.
So there's a stanza in this, and please forgive me if I recite it back wrong, but you say something like, someone told me there's a better place than this where I can go and see my mother's kiss.
Receive my mother's kiss, yeah.
A place so full of love up above. So, you know, I hear your songs, and I think, how can she, over all these years, continue to just put her heart out on the page? I mean, that must be so...
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, just that's my life force is what I always tell people. You know, it's just, I mean, it's just something I have to do, you know. And I learned some of that from my dad, you know.
From his poetry?
Watching him work, just hearing what he had to say about writing and you know, the things he would tell me. One of the things he said to me was, never censor yourself. You know, my dad would write about anything from a cat sleeping on the windowsill to a wreck on the highway. Just real life stuff.
So here we are in Georgia, where you've lived in both Atlanta and Macon. And I wonder what you think about the music of the South. Is there really a difference to the music that's written in the Deep South in places like Alabama or Mississippi or Georgia?
Well, there used to be. I mean, you know, when country music was different, you know, the old country stuff and, of course, all the great blues stuff, you know, from back then. Contemporary country music, it's just, you know, it's so different now. It just doesn't really apply. I mean, there are some younger artists, you know, who are out of the South, who are writing and, you know, doing a really good job, like Jason Isbell. But, I mean, you know, the commercial country stuff is, most of it's written on Music Row, you know.
Yeah.
By a group of people, you know.
You mean in Nashville?
Anywhere from 2 to 3 to 5 people who may, some of whom may be from the South, some may be from Connecticut, you know. I mean, part of it is the difference between, you know, old country music was rural. You know, the artists were all out of the, you know, rural areas. So that's changed a lot now. But basically, I mean, in terms of being a good songwriter and having soul and having a perspective and everything, I mean, I think that just ultimately comes from inside of you. And it doesn't matter whether you're, you know, on a farm in Iowa or, you know, you're living in an apartment in New York City, or, you know, whether you have money or don't have money. It's just really about, you know, your own, how you see the world.
That is songwriter and country legend Lucinda Williams. She will perform tonight at Chastain Park Amphitheater at 7 p.m. Such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. You ask really good questions that I have to sit and go, hmm.
Making you go, hmm, is what I live for, Lucinda Williams. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
The sun came up, it was another day. And the sun went down, you were blown away. Why'd you let go of your guitar? Why'd you ever let it go, that far drunken angel?
And that's our show for today. But tell me, what is your favorite cult classic, movie or TV show? We talked about MST3K, but what cult classic is your fave? Is it Twin Peaks, Buffy, Firefly, maybe Veronica Mars? Which is the best one? Call us at 404-500-9457, or you can tweet us. The show is at OST Talk, and I'm at Celeste Headley. Our show is produced by Sean Powers, Ryan McFadden, and Trevor Young. Our senior producer is Emily Curitan. Tanya Ott is our VP of radio, and our engineer is Tyler Morris. Our interns this summer were Candace Spates and Charles Lucas. We wish them the best, and just remind them to make good choices. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day.